an aging population, and to realize that in terms of mission work in this country especially, it's a vital thing. They're here. Whether we know it or not, when I went to, I taught in Brazil a couple of years back, and I asked them, well, what do you want, adult education or homiletics or what? And I gave the name of my aging course also as one of them. That's the one they were sure they didn't want. And they said, we don't have any old people. And it's almost true. Compared to our country and some of the European countries, there is not a problem of aging. As I sat in the hotel in downtown Porto Alegre, it was seldom that you would see an old person passing in the street. And when I say passing in the street, they walk on the sidewalk and in the street and everything. You can see about 10,000 people an hour. But the point is that we have them, and we'd better be aware. The statistics vary, obviously. I would say we've become aware of it in the last 10 years. Prior to that, there was only a trickle of articles here and there, and nobody was doing much statistical work. There are 23 million people in the United States over the age of 65. And that raises an interesting question. What do you mean by aging or older people? Now, everyone is aging unless he dies. So if you don't like to get old, the alternative is you've got to die. The age 65 has been under fire. I don't know what your picture of an aging person is. Frequently we think of some poor old lady with didn't eat enough calcium, and she's lying in a bed in a nursing home. 5% or less than that even of the people over 65 are in nursing homes. The rest are mostly in their own homes, and a few in homes of their adult children. And this is increasing rapidly. Shirley Bergman, who heads up the Institute or whatever they call it for the aging out in the Seward, has done some statistical work and maintains the Missouri Senate is older than that, than the nation. By the year 2030, that's usually the year that they talk about, I don't expect to be around, but by that time, one person out of four in this country will be over 65. The most rapidly growing percentage-wise, part of our population are the people 80 and over. Why is all of this? We're not sure. Science still doesn't know too much about the human lifespan, although there was an interesting article in yesterday's paper that they think they've discovered a new enzyme or something that will make the lifespan of 100 plus fairly common. I don't know whether that will work or not. And obviously this has advantages and disadvantages. There was a doctor on some program the other day who said, what's all this about postmenopausal problems? And this is kind of new. And he said, well, 100 years ago, practically all women were dead by the time they hit 50. There wasn't much postmenopausal period. In the year 1900 in this country, the life expectancy was about 41 years. For a baby born today, a male baby can expect to live to be about 82, and a female about 87, and it's going up all the time. And with a host of problems connected with it, not only medical, because now you're going to have the question of, do you want grandma to be put on a machine? You got the whole living will thing. But also economic. Since I will be drawing Social Security next month, I encourage all of you to keep paying faithfully. I have put quite a bit in, but I know that my father-in-law, I don't know if you know what Social Security cost when it was first started. $40 a year was maximum. And there are a lot of people who have drawn everything they put into it in about 2 months. Now, it's increasing, and by the time some of you guys hit the ministry, and there's no deduction or anything else. You pay it on your housing and everything. it will be about 15%, which you can simply take off the top of your gross salary. And that's to keep the rest of us going. Medicare, Medicaid, and all of this argument about that. So there are just a host of problems. In addition, spiritually. In other words, we're in the midst of an explosion and a revolution. I became very much aware of it when I left Springfield and went out to New Jersey and started a new mission on the shore, and found that I had a congregation, 80% of whom were retirees. They weren't broke. The first Christmas, and I just started in January, and that first Christmas, our collection was over $18,000. I said, what's going on? Now, that wasn't every Sunday. Too bad it wasn't. Well, they were getting ready for the income tax. It was the end of the year. So I think the first thing you have to do is face up to the myths, and that would be my first point. Learn to understand older people. And the first myth is there is no such thing as an older person in the abstract. We like to think of it. That's one of the myths that Butler, and this was a textbook I've used, I'm not using it anymore, Robert Butler, M.D. This was a Pulitzer Prize winner at the time. And he headed up the National Agency on Aging, which comes under Health and Human Services or whatever. They keep changing names. That's one thing that irritates old people, by the way. It irritates me that Synod can't make up its mind what it wants to call half the agency, the BPES, and they didn't like to be called BPES, so now it's BHIS or something. And as if that changes anything, and it's very irritating. At any rate, I found in New Jersey, I was serving in 11 different villages. One of them had about almost a quarter of a million people, and growing rapidly. And so you were faced with the question, how do you do evangelism in such circumstances? So to understand them and understand people in relationship to the church, I think there are two areas here that we need to be aware of. Number one is, what do you do for them? What do they need from a church? It's not money. And we've got all kinds of people conducting workshops. Southern Illinois U in Edwardsville, for instance, has a major master's degree now in gerontology. But that's only part of it. The other part is, what do you do with them? A while back, LACUSA had a, no, was it LACUSA? Yes, they had their meeting here in St. Louis down at the Chase. Oh, this is 4 or 5 years ago, and usually in connection with their meetings, they have a theme of some kind, and that year's theme was aging. And I insisted that my whole class at that time go. It had been widely advertised all over the place in St. Louis. There was hardly anybody showed up except my class, which would indicate, you know, we've got psychological problems. A lot of people don't like to deal with aging or with death because it has a negative connotation. We still have a youth-oriented culture, but if you watch the ads and the television commercials, Johnson & Johnson now are trying to sell their baby powder, not to babies, but to older people. Same product, but a totally different pitch, which would indicate something's going on. So the second part, number one thing is, what can you do for them? And that's part of our mission work. And the second thing is, how can you use them? And this is why I always emphasize ministry to the aging, which a lot of older people will say, you know, who needs it? They don't like to be looked down upon. But many of them are crying aloud to be used. There was a man at that meeting who at one time was the treasurer of the state of Missouri and had been treasurer of the Missouri Senate, and who retired, he reached retirement age, and with tears in his eyes, I don't know which church he's a member of, but he said, nobody gives me anything to do. And here's a man who probably knows more about Senate than anybody else, has been working with the church as a dedicated Lutheran layman, and he said, I'm lonely. He said, they just walk around me. I discovered in New Jersey, in the unlikely town named Forked River, my relatives kept referring to it as Hooked Knee or something, down in the Pine Barrens, we met the problem, how do you do evangelism in retirement villages? And there are going to be lots of them all over the place, not only Florida. I flew out of Orlando one time, and as you fly out, you see all the trailer villages. Thousands, tens of thousands of them. And there are certain areas, for instance, Chicago people go to Arkansas, and so do former presidents of Senate, I think. There are certain areas, New Jersey, we were only about 70 miles south of Atlantic City, but the reason that was an area, we called it the Florida of the North. There's an ocean stream bends in, and the temperature is about 15 degrees warmer in the winter than it is in New York or Jersey City or some of those places. A lot of people don't want to move too far away from their grandchildren and their adult children. And so we had people from North Jersey and from Long Island. Well, to illustrate what I mean by evangelism with these people, this became a problem. You can't, in most retirement villages, they're very protected. In many cases, they have their own police force. You can't get a mailing list. We tried that. In fact, I worked with a council of churches, and they simply turned you down. You can't canvass, because if you do, you'll be arrested. It's against the law. And so if you ring a doorbell and anybody comes up and says, who's in that house, you'd better know who. That you're a visitor, knowing the family, and you're not just pestering people. We stewed about that for quite a while until somebody came up with the idea, well, let's try a Bible class in the evening, because we could put it into their villages. Old people don't like to drive at night, by the way, so keep that in mind. They're just a host of practical things. But this worked very well. We started one and had two of our own families. One was a widow of a former Missouri Senate pastor, and invited neighbors. We discovered another thing about older people, especially if they are isolated. They'll come to anything. You could put on a dog fight with two cats and they'd come. And they would be early, because one of the great needs of older people, or problems, is loneliness. That suddenly they're shifted. The president of my congregation there had been the man in charge of all of the telephone repair service for New Jersey Bell for years. One of the top men. And suddenly I think he summarized it by saying to me one day, if anybody asks me to play shuffleboard once more, I'm going to wrap that damn stick around his neck. And this is another myth that we have, that people, one guy finally caved in, bought a boat and a fishing rod, and he hated it. He finally took a hammer and put a hole in the boat and sank it. He said, this is not what I want to do. Now, you spent your whole life being meaningful, doing meaningful things, and suddenly you're nobody. At any rate, that worked. We invited, I think the first one, two other couples, and they simply were asked, would you like to come over? We're going to have a Bible study. You can meet our pastor. We'll have some cake and coffee. And nobody was in a hurry. I think we started around 7, and I think we're still there at midnight. And all I did, I think they took Psalm 23 or something very familiar, at the end of the evening, I said, would you like to continue? Well, by all means. So it was started on a weekly basis. I think I took about the first month or so, and then I said, well, now what do we do? We can't fill this whole house. And by the time I left, we had 19 such groups going. It was the finest way to do evangelism, because, number one, you could get the people. It was legal. Number two, you were taking advantage of the fact that they were lonely, And in many cases, these people were religious, but their churches I ran into so many former Lutherans, some people who had been officers in their congregation, and I'd say, where's your home church? Well, we haven't heard from them. They took us off the ropes, which I think is a rotten thing to do. But a lot of guys are doing it. I don't know where he is, and they're too lazy to find out. In many cases, these people were only 60, 70 miles away, and they'd simply been abandoned. Well, at any rate, that's an example of evangelism and mission work, that you have to adapt it. If we had tried to ring doorbells and scare these people, they'd have slammed the doors in their faces anyhow. You know, yell, I'm here to try to get you to join my church. Never ask one of them, but a great many of them did. They said, gee, we like this, we know your pastor, and we know your lay leaders. Can we come to your church? And sure, in many cases, if they were afraid to drive, we had somebody pick them up and whatnot. That's one example of what I mean by ministry with, because these 19 Bible classes, I couldn't teach them all, nor did I want to. You had to train lay leaders to keep the thing going. And eventually the pastor could get to them, or you'd find yourself counseling them and so on. So, Butler and many others talk about the first thing to do about old people is to avoid the myths. Who decided that 65 is retirement age, and we've been fussing with that lately now? Dr. Klon, for instance, when he hit 70, it was my joy to tell him that he had to retire, and he was angry. In fact, he got a letter from the pension board saying he had been discontinued or something, and he was yelling all over the place. I don't know whether it was wise or not. He wanted to keep teaching. But he was simply told, you're too old. It was Bismarck, the Iron Duke in the Weimar Republic, who had a problem. His problem was he had unemployment. And so you solve unemployment in two ways. And number one, you keep as many young people out of the workforce as long as possible. So you say, well, if you're going to go to the seminary, if we have too many pastors, we'll put two more years on seminary education. That's how vicarage got started. Are you aware of it? That's how it got started. Years back in the late 30s, I guess, they had a whole classes around here, and there would be one call. And there's some of those men never did any of the ministry. So somebody got the bright idea, why don't we slow it down so we'll send these guys out at vicarage? We don't care what they do. They don't get paid much. They're not married anyhow, because that's against God's rules. And so now it gave you a little breathing spell, and so this thing has evolved into the dignified thing it now is, which I call slave labor, but that's all right. At any rate, you have to realize that's where 65 came. It was Bismarck single-handedly who told the whole world, and we believe it, when you get to 65, you're old. I have a new definition. There are many definitions of old. I think you're old. You know it, at least. When somebody asks you who you are, and you tell him who you were, you can roll that one around. And I found that so true that I would ask people, who are you? And they'd say, I used to be. And if you knew them well enough, you could get a little funny and say, I didn't ask you who you used to be. I asked you whom you are now. In many cases, these people would say, I don't know. The wives didn't have that much trouble. And many of those of that age, of course, had been housewives, and now they had a new house. You had to pay cash, by the way. They didn't trust you to keep on living. And they had new appliances, and they could keep on being who they were. But it was the men who had great trouble. And I think as you get more working wives, you're going to find that same problem. What are some of the myths? The myth of aging. And the truth is that as people get older, they become more different. They do not become more alike. And that's why it's so difficult to talk about aging people. You can divide them young age, middle age, and old age. It's the older people who begin to have the problems. The myth of unproductivity, that thing has been blown sky high so often, and yet everybody believes it. If you're retired, you really, well, you got a rocking chair. You can always go to Spain. You know, old people, the word is out. Don't go to Spain. Because Spain is nothing but steps all over the place, and you can kill yourself trying to get up those steps. The myth of disengagement. There were a couple of authors over who did a survey in Kansas City some years ago, which became very famous, known as the disengagement theory. Something like this, that at a certain age, old people, want to disengage the gears, and it's good for them, and it's good for society. And the debate has raged. The better understanding now is that, yes, at a certain age, you may want to, and you may actually disengage, but you don't stay disengaged. You don't sit on the porch and rock your life away. That you re-engage on a different level. Let me give you some advice that a lot of pastors never got. And that is, if you ever decide to retire, before you do, make sure you've got something else lined up. Otherwise, nobody's going to want you. We've got pastors, highly competent retired pastors in this area, who never get invited to preach or do anything. In my own case, I will be on the retirement status February 1st. Number one, I've told the seminary I'll continue to teach free, because if I don't, the government's going to take my Social Security away anyhow. And secondly, I'm assistant to the pastor at Chapel of the Cross, and I'm gradually stepping up. I'll probably be working harder, except I can call my own shots, which is what I want. I don't want to go to any more meetings, faculty meetings or anything else. If I can avoid it, I'll go to some probably. But it's a re-engagement. The myth of inflexibility, that old people are set in their ways. Again, that has been exploded, even politically. Old people are not automatically Republican. My dad died when he was 69. He wouldn't have voted Republican. He would have rather moved to Russia, I think. And most older people are much more liberal in their social views, for instance, social service views, than younger people. Now, the myth of senility, and you should hear Reed Butler on this one. He laughs at the medical community. He said a great many of them simply, if they don't know what to do and don't want to bother with old people, they say he's just senile. And God knows how many people have died prematurely. Or a reversible brain injury or brain damage of some kind, that a doctor said, well, he's old, what do you expect? And the point is that physically, mentally, emotionally, in many ways, you don't expect anything. You get to know the individual and deal with them. Or the myth of serenity, that old age is folding your hands and rocking away until the Lord lifts you on angel wings to heaven. So we have, and I think it's being battled rather vigorously now, what we call ageism. And if you study it anthropologically, in various cultures and various times, William Graham Sumner, for instance, has a rather large section. What has been the attitude toward aging? You look in Scripture and you find a double standard. And the human race has always been sort of schizophrenic about this. On the one hand, in many cultures, and this is true yet to a large extent with Asiatics. And I've had some Asiatics in this course, and we've always very interested, somebody from Hong Kong or something, and they tell us, you know, how they deal with their older aging relatives. And they're much better at it than we are. Nevertheless, we've always had a love-hate relationship. In some cultures, when people get to a certain age, they're expected, as the tribe moves on, simply to stay, lie down, and stop eating. In Alaska, some of the Aboriginal Indians there, you can find platforms that they build them for the old people. Now, when we go, you get up on there and die. And so then you'll find that throughout a lot of literature. And even in, Ecclesiastes, the last chapter. And Scripture, on the one hand, is honest. It isn't fun to get old. and you become prey to all kinds of things. The grinders cease because they are few, Ecclesiastes says. You know, you begin to lose your teeth. And Shakespeare has that lovely passage on the ages of man and the last one. You know, the old man who sands teeth, sands eyes, sands everything. You start out with the infant mewling and puking in his nurse's arms, and then it goes through the bearded part, you know, the soldier, strong and husky, and then the judge, and finally you sink into oblivion. It's you start out weak, and you end up weak. So I think if we're going to perform ministry to the aging, we need to come to know them. I have a graduate student who'll be doing doing an independent study with me. He's going to be doing a lot of interviewing out at Altenheim, just talking to these people. And the more you talk to them, instead of merely looking and judging, I know all about them, you come to see them as individuals. So there's this ambivalence. We have a senior citizens group at church, which is community. It's based in our church, but it's not one of our church organizations. And I've had their devotions occasionally. One old guy got up once and he said, "I know what we got to do." I don't remember what they were arguing about. "Go down to the drugstore and take all those birth control pills and throw them out." There was a stunned silence first. What's that got to do with it? And it began to dawn. He was talking about what I was talking about. Who's going to pay our pensions if you guys stop having babies? Or maybe you're the ones that should be worrying about it. As the birth rate approaches zero, and you get more and more on this end, what you got in the middle is fewer people supporting more and more, especially in the upper reaches, and that will have political consequences and everything else. Well, what do they need? And I think, again, the Lutheran Brotherhood did a very interesting study. They allocated about $200,000 a few years back, an experimental program called LEE, L-E-E, Life Enrichment for the Elderly, I think. And they operated it in some large cities and some small towns and whatnot, trying to find out what, at a practical level, works in ministry to and with the aging. It's in the library here, and we take a look at it when we have this course. But what do older people need? Money? Most of them don't. The major problem are with old non-white women. Yeah, that's a triple whammy. If you're old, you're a woman, and you're non-white. And many of, if you look in the papers these days, they're talking about the 100 neediest families. Just read a few of those. In many cases, this is a problem. You've got a grandmother who's suddenly got her grandkids dumped on her, and she's trying to get by on $120 a month, which ought to, you know, $120 today won't even fix the tires on your new Chevrolet. Nobody laughs at that. You haven't heard that? That's the latest scandal. All the 85 and 86 GM cars, the rear tires are wearing out at 6,000 miles. GM is secretly replacing them because they misaligned the wheels in the factory. Anyway, they need money, health, and the health, and this is good. For a long time, doctors paid very little attention to aging, nurses likewise. Most medical schools now have a specialty in geriatrics, and it's a growing thing and interest in keeping people alive, yes, but also keeping them healthy and relatively happy. Now, you don't expect a man 65 to be able to run upstairs as he did when he was 25, but we have when we complain about hospital bills and whatnot, the revolution has been fantastic. There are a great many people who live into old age who, in the early part of this very century, would have been considered, for instance, pneumonia was considered the old man's friend. Everybody died of pneumonia. If you got any sickness at all and they put you in a bed, the next thing you had pneumonia and it took you to heaven. Today, They say if you have a bad cold, wait till it turns into pneumonia. They can cure that with antibiotics and a great many things. So there is a need. Housing, and here I think there are many opportunities. Our church down in Kirkwood has sort of set the pattern here. There's money for housing in many cases, but what they need is entrepreneurship. And that's what the church can provide. I don't think it cost Kirkwood's church down there a penny from the congregation, but it's they have had to take responsibility, and so they have Concordia House. And if you're using federal money and federal low-interest loans, you can't say only Missouri Synod Lutherans. You have to open it. At least you have to have a certain percentage. And you have to avoid racial inequality and all those things. But nevertheless, there's a great opportunity there. Even as Bethesda, for instance, is branching out now with its, what do they call it? They're building one down our way in Florissant. These houses, shelter houses, so they don't all have to go way up to Bethesda, but can be taken care of mentally deficient people. Transportation is something that we need to be aware of. Many of our older churches must have been designed by an athlete. My home church in Buffalo, there is no way you can get into that church without walking up about 84 steps. See, they decided they didn't want to go too far down for the basement, so they built it above ground and they built the church on top of it. To come down the front steps is an experience in itself. And if you want to experience it, go down to Holy Cross and go in the front entrance. Now, they do have a rail, but you'll still get vertigo. And you almost feel like crawling on your hands and knees. But beyond that, transportation. Many older people should not drive, cannot drive, don't want to drive after dark. This is why our church has a bus, and we're going into our fourth van now. We need it, if you want, and not just to come to church. There are people who need to get to doctors and all kinds of other activities, and this is a major service. Companionship. Now we're into what we can really do. Provide koinonia. And as I indicated, I think that one of the best evangelism tools you have is to provide companionship. Somebody to talk to listen to, and to share. Comforting in the face of sickness and death, that's our bag too. That's why we need to know a little bit more about death and dying and grief and bereavement. You're going to have an awful lot of widows in your churches, no doubt about it. Men persist in marrying, by and large, younger women, and the women live 7 or 8 years longer than the men. So the average woman who's married can anticipate being a widow for at least 10 years. They'll get all the money, too, of course, if there's any left. You realize, read the New Testament, you have that thing in Acts 6 of the widows. You realize that the church set that as one of its major functions, to take care of widows. And again, that's a story anthropologically of India, you know, throw yourself on your husband's funeral pyre. Widows and in the ancient world, and to this day in many parts of the world, have no social standing, no economic standing, nothing. Somebody needs to take care of them. We're told that in the early church, next to the pastor, the most important man in the congregation was the man who took care of the widows. It was considered a major ministry to bring the comfort of the Lord Jesus Christ. But beyond that, and this is something I'm trying to work on, what else can we offer? And the major thing we need to offer people is meaning. And I realize that can get complicated. The two groups of population committing suicide the most are older people first, and secondly, the adolescent. The adolescent to whom nobody has taught how to find meaning in life, and the older people who think life once had meaning, but what does it mean? You're sick, you're old, you're lonely, nobody really wants you around, you can't produce anything, and you're just taking up space, and you might as well knock it off. And This is based, obviously, on a theology that says death is the end of it. Put him out of his misery. Our theology says you better look out. It is not. So the church can do a lot for older people, and I think it's a calling of our social ministry. Synod now has a commission on aging, and we've had some off and on, and much more is being done. But what can they do for as the church? And I think that's the first thing you got to tell them. The church isn't coming to you to serve you, but you are part of the church. And as the church, obviously, they can do evangelism. And in many cases, not in every case, obviously, but in many cases, they're marvelous. Young people don't like to get involved because your ego is involved. You might get turned down. Older people say, who cares? I got nothing to lose. And in many cases, they have the time, and they're perfectly willing to make you shunning calls and to make evangelism calls. My wife and I found in New Jersey one of the best days that we could have for making contact with unchurched people was the day the Social Security checks came. And I can recall spending almost the full day in the supermarket. We talked to the manager and said, we'll be around, we buy here, but not today. And just walk up and down the aisles, and everybody would talk to you. All you had to do was smile a little bit, and they're jumping at you. And very soon, you'd find that they didn't mind at all if you introduced the idea of religion, of faith in Jesus Christ. Once in a while, you'd hit a Jew. We didn't have too many. But they were pretty good-natured about it, too. Guidance of youth. And this is where we're really missing the boat. I think, we think that we hire a young guy to take care of the youth, and that's it. And in many cases, he isn't old enough himself to be able to give the kind of guide. Sure, he can run the program, an activity program, and that's fine. But who in the church is telling people what it means to have lived under the gospel for 60, 70 years? And the youth are asking that question. And it's the older people. Now, somehow we've got to bring them together. There is a national program which is quite helpful. They really provide some literature called GAP, Generation Alliance Program. And it has been discovered that if you skip a generation, you have much closer rapport. For instance, kids and their parents don't get along too well, but they do with their grandparents. And we grandparents think it's great fun to spoil our grandkids. I've got 11. And our kids yell at us once in a while. Yeah, spoiling them. I say, that's my privilege. And the kids love it. And I think even in the church, this generation alliance, the young people need the guidance more than merely being yelled at. They need to sit down with somebody. And the older people love it. Even in nursing homes, we discovered that. They've discovered, too, that bringing pets in, anything to maintain the humanity, and above all, the humanity in Christ. So there's a large, unevangelized segment. Now, don't count on it that as you get older, you automatically get more religious. That's probably not true. Somebody has to approach them, and frequently with the law, although with older people who are getting kind of creaky and sick, the law is being preached. And incidentally, people, as you get older, you get sick differently. That was the trouble with our medical institution in this country. We're attuned to acute illness. Bring them in, cut them open, sew them up, and send them back to work and raise the flag. We want another one. Then you get an older person. They're never going to get much better. They have multiple problems. And the symptoms, incidentally, are different for the very same disease. The symptoms in old age are different. And that's why medicine tried to turn away from them. But we do need to see this as a large, unevangelized segment of our society. People who at one time may have known Christ. Many of them do, but they have drifted away, and if we don't get to them with the gospel, they're going to end up in hell. Sometimes it's the church's fault because the church has deserted them. So So I believe, you know, I could say a lot more. As I said, this is a strong force for the church. I think it's a challenge, but I hope we never look at it as, oh God, what are we going to do now? And a fuss with these old, if you see them, get to know them and work with them, you're going to discover that these people are some of the best missionaries we have to support the pastor and to support and to keep the program of the church on track. You know, fulfilling the mission of the church for Christ. I think I'll stop there. I don't know how long you go. You may have time for a comment or question or two. There's much more, obviously, that could be said.
How much do you know about the program that they have operating in Concordia Kirkwood? I find that to be a real useful way of ministering to the elderly through the vehicle of the church.
Yeah.
And do they have a volunteer system set up there where people will come in from the church?
I think you might go down sometime and visit it. It would certainly be worthwhile. We've occasionally had Pastor, what's his name?
Shadle.
Come up and speak in our class. Now, there are certain limitations. In other words, if you're going to be using federal or state money, you have to find out first what you can do and what you can't do.
Mm-hmm.
One thing you can always do, obviously, is invite people to church. We found up in Buffalo a number of years back, we wanted to build it's called Niagara Lutheran Home now. It's a hospital for terminally ill people, almost all old, and practically everybody's carried out dead. And first of all, we had to get the churches together with InterSynodical and raise about $100,000. But that wasn't nearly enough. Then you went to the state, and the state said, hooray! And they just hand you the money, because they were looking for somebody who would establish something like this. And it's now, I think, they probably have around 500 beds. It's grown every year. And you'll find that there's a lot of that. Yeah.
You talked about these trailer villages and retirement villages, and in a class with Dr. Bergman, we looked at Sun City. That was a fake name, but I don't remember who the author was, out in the western part.
Mm.
And it talked about age segregation. Would you like to address that a little bit?
It's a good question, because I ran into that in New Jersey, and you'll find you've got two different points of view among the older people. We had in this gathering of the churches, one question we tried to answer, should we establish churches around these villages? And we chewed around on that for a year, and finally somebody said, let's get some of the retirees in here next thing. And almost to a person, they said no. Now, the Episcopal Church went ahead and did it, and it flopped. And in my congregation, I had folks who lived in town and wouldn't touch, you know, a retirement village. Others who needed the security of it. But the consensus was, we don't want a church with just old people, as if we're, you know, some kind of queer. We want a church where there's a Sunday school, where there's a choir, where there's youth work, and where we're mingling with the community. And out there in New Jersey, I knew that the ALC, through one of these arrangements, had the right to build a church at Crestwood. And they have. And I was just in Indiana, and I saw somebody who'd been there, and he said, it ain't working either. Our church was in the town. And at that time, I didn't even have a building. I was just using the town hall. But I think that's an important thing. And I think our churches in Florida, for instance, are finding that. They have big memberships in the winter, you know. And the reason they do is people don't want you to segregate. They don't, because immediately say, there go all those old fuddy-duddies, you know. We still have a lot of ages, and even in Watch the Comedy and everything else. But I would say the majority would say, if I get to a nursing home, okay, then you can segregate me if I have to be. But before that, keep me in the main line of life. So That was a real issue on how you build churches. We had the idea one time, and they were willing to give us the property. We'd have about 10 different churches around these villages. Take your choice, Catholic, Lutheran, whatnot. And they laughed us out of court on that one. Thank heaven. Incidentally, that Crestwood, which is one of the biggest in New Jersey, has a beautiful funeral home right at the entrance. I said one thing, didn't that bother you? Do you know it didn't bother them? They said, we know it. Older people face death with greater equanimity. They had a grand time at funerals. Because as soon as the body was buried, then you went to a restaurant and they had a blowout. Two times you had a party. Number one, when you got 80, if you lived that long. That's an old German idea. And secondly, on the day of the funeral. And if you didn't go as pastor, you were insulting them. But they, these, especially the religious people, faced death very realistically. In grief therapy, we call it preparatory grief. That by the time the person dies, they've got it all. They've faced the reality. They know it. And it's just a matter of when. And you don't have this sudden shock and everything else. The preparatory grieving has been done. In many cases, they've got their affairs in order. They're in better shape than when death enters a younger family, where suddenly, you know, that's not supposed to happen. They are aware of it. The old guard in Forked River met once a week. They had 100 members, and you couldn't get in till somebody died and made room. They had this big plaque in the wall, and they had little brass plaques in this oak or something, and whenever a member died, his blank thing was taken down, and his name and day of his death was inscribed. Every time they met, they'd look, stare right at it. Wonder whose that one is, the next one. And there was an equanimity about facing it at the end of life. Who was it, Socrates or somebody said, don't be afraid of death, because if death is, you're not. And if you are, death is not. That's quite sort of an atheist way of looking at it. Okay, anything else? Time's about up, huh?
Thank you very much.
Good, and I've got a whole batch of stuff, and we're getting more stuff in the library. I would encourage you, as you get time, to get a little more aware of it. I think it's an opportunity.
Okay.
Thank you for calling me. I would have woken up in about 5 minutes.
Yeah.
My granddaughter walked in. My daughter with her.